You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters Local 533 and Roofers Local 20. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. And Roofers Local 20 Apprenticeship provides the highest quality roof applicators in the region. Accredited by the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Apprenticeship Training, our program provides Local 20 contractors with a workforce second to none. Craftsmanship and quality is what we do. On time and within budget is how we do it. For more information on Roofers Apprenticeship, call 913-281-2527. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, it's 38 days and counting that the Black Jewel coal miners of Harlan County, Kentucky are occupying the tracks, saying, "No pay, we stay." We'll get their story. Then, when you ask labor leaders why American unions have shrunk, most mention the PATCO strike defeat at the hands of Ronald Reagan in 1981. We'll revisit the strike with labor historian Joseph McCartan and ask why the air traffic controllers lost and what have been the long-term results. In the news, Truman Hospital workers make some progress in their bid for a union, and EEOC sues University of Kansas Medical Center for retaliation against a whistleblower. Now for the news.
Now for the news from our side, September 12, 2019. The week after lab workers and techs at Truman Medical Center held a rally to support their organizing with SEIU Healthcare, one leader of the organizing efforts who spoke out and featured in the media was called into a one-on-one meeting with her manager and disciplined. "It was very intimidating and made me fear I'll lose my job," explained Shay Ross, a specimen receiver in the lab at Truman Hospital Hill. "I've never done anything less than meet or exceed expectations in my performance reviews in my 13 years here, but once I start advocating for a union so we can improve our jobs and patient care, I am targeted. I feel this is a direct retaliation." So did SEIU, and they filed unfair labor practice charges against the hospital with the National Labor Relations Board. The charge states that discipline was placed in a worker's record as a result of her participation in and speaking to the media at the rally. It is against the law to punish a worker for exercising her right to organize. Lenny Jones, state director for SEIU Healthcare Missouri, said, "The behavior on display at Truman is unacceptable. As a union, we're prepared to use all resources available to us to hold management accountable and ensure workers can win their union free from retaliation. The fact that Truman is waging their anti-union campaign on the dime of taxpayers who we know overwhelmingly support a worker's right to organize is shameful. Kansas City and Jackson County taxpayers subsidize Truman Medical Center to the tune of $36.2 million a year." A number of citizens began calling and emailing Truman CEO Charlie Shields to tell him to stop violating workers' rights and interfering with the workers' right to organize. Shields has agreed to meet, and details are being worked out. Meanwhile, the labor board is investigating, and Shea is still being harassed.
On August 30th, David Proston, the founder and developer of the bi-monthly newsletter for union stewards called Steward Update, and the union communication service that sold the books on labor, many of them how-to books, wrote the obituary for his baby. Proston had retired 5 years ago and adopted it out to Cornell's University Worker Institute, which promised to maintain both the newsletter and book distribution. David said Steward Update newsletter was an essential tool for tens of thousands of union stewards across North America for 30 years. The cause of death? 5 years of abuse, neglect, and mismanagement on part of its adoptive parents. Proston was a labor journalist. The newsletter had many guest articles and always a theme, like how to deal with bullies in the workplace or how to argue past practice grievances. For a number of years, it was published in English, French, and Spanish. Unions subscribed for all their stewards. It was an important tool of labor education. By 2014, Proston wanted to retire. After the Worker Institute promised to continue his life's work, he formally gifted the publishing company, Union Communication Service, to them. He says it was comfortably profitable. But by the time Cornell declared it did, Steward Update had lost two-thirds of its 650 unions that subscribed. He claims that up to 70,000 stewards got the newsletter every 2 months. Proston said the content was increasingly irrelevant to stewards. It had become too academic. When he saw this, Proston asked for the newsletter back, but was told gifts to Cornell couldn't be returned. The gifting of UCS also includes the UCS Labor Books Catalog, which included Proston's own Union Stewards Complete Guide, which had sold more than 100,000 copies by the time of the turnover to Cornell, and in 15 other books and pamphlets published by UCS. Also in the catalog were titles from other publishers that Proston saw as union serious building tools. Cornell let most of the UCS titles go out of print. Over its 5 years of control, it created just two new offerings: Stick with the Union Post-it Notes and a $21 tote bag promoting the Unionist website. When told that Cornell was pulling the plug on UCS, Proston asked that whatever books remained in the inventory be given to pro-labor nonprofit for their distribution. Proston was told this could happen only if he agreed to a gag order, promising he would not disparage the school for what had happened. Otherwise, the books would be pulped.
On September 6th, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, sued the University of Kansas Medical Center, or KUMC. The suit alleges that KU violated federal law when it discharged a manager who alerted officials that his department had instructed staff to give hiring preference to millennials over older applicants. According to the EEOC, in 2014, KUMC's Associate Vice Chancellor for Information Resources and Chief Information Officer advised managers in the Information Resources departments to focus on hiring younger people. After Jeffrey Thomas, who supervised the IT help desk, reported the age bias to KUMC officials, the Vice Chancellor ordered a reorganization of the Information Resources Department and eliminated Thomas's position, resulting in his termination. Later, an internal investigation confirmed Thomas's allegations and identified at least one instance where an applicant was not hired because of her age. Such alleged conduct violates the anti-retaliation provisions of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967, which prohibits employers from taking negative actions against employees who report age discrimination by their employer. The EEOC filed its lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the District of Kansas. The EEOC seeks monetary relief for Thomas, liquidated damages, and an order preventing future retaliatory conduct. Hiring discrimination is one of the most difficult types of employment discrimination to identify because applicants almost never know the reason they were not selected for a job, says Andrea G. Baran, who is Baran, the EEOC's regional attorney in St. Louis. Individuals like Mr. Thomas should be commended and protected from retaliation for standing up against discriminatory hiring practices. KUMC sent the following statement to the Kansas City Star, stating only that the University of Kansas Medical Center is committed to the inclusion of all members of our campus community and takes very seriously its responsibility to prevent and eliminate discrimination. The university strives to foster an environment where its employees feel comfortable and are protected when speaking up and reporting complaints of discrimination. That's all, folks. The news tonight was read by Elaine McMillan, Tom Gepkin, and I'm Jen Zaman.
It's a dirty job, but the money's clean. We breathe rock dust to make long green. Five generations have went down in a hole in the ground. Deep in a hill, dark as a tomb, many men have met their doom. They know the risk but still go down in a hole in the ground. Hole in the ground, digging like a mole in a hole in the ground. Sun's gonna shine when I get out of this hole in the ground.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Chris Mann, the host for this evening's first half of the show. The song you've just heard was Kentucky Miners' Hole in the Ground by Dee Hackford. Tonight we are so excited to be able to interview Black Jewel coal miner Chris Rowe, who is standing on the tracks blocking a coal train. The miners have been standing, sitting, playing, and praying on the railroad tracks, leading to their now bankrupt place of work, Black Jewel Mine. All coal mining songs relate how hard, dangerous, and dirty coal mining is. Imagine you have worked to accumulate $4,200, and you go to your bank and find that your check from the mine owner has bounced. What do you do? Tonight, these creative, hardworking, honest workers find themselves blocking the train that holds the coal that they have just dug, and their lives are turned around. We wanted to know from Kansas City, how are you all doing? It's been a long way. I think you're in your seventh week.
Yeah, that's right. Seven weeks. You know, everybody, I guess most is just running high and low. You know, we don't know what's going on from one day to the next. Of course, it's been a long thing, and every day it's different news coming out, but everybody's doing pretty good. We're sitting down here. It's a little hot, but we're all making it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the activities you do are everything from church to playing games and singing, I hear. Is that true?
Yeah. Because, you know, a lot of these guys, we work with them, but the wives, you know, we just put faces to the names now. You know, we go to work and tell stories about home life. You know, we never get to see the other guys' wives. You know, we do.
Nice.
Everybody's getting along pretty good. But, yeah, we're playing cornhole. The kids are coloring. I mean, there's a lot of stuff new down here now.
And so what brought you to the tracks? Can you tell our listeners in our area? What made you take this stand?
Well, you know, July is usually when everybody goes on vacation. Right? So everybody's working and everybody's going on vacation and stuff. And while we're on vacation, we realize the company filed for bankruptcy, and all of our checks that they gave us got took out of our bank.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, being 23 years of mining and, you know, we're down on vacation and I had to borrow money from my dad to get back home. That hurt a little bit. And not only that, the week we worked before the vacation, he didn't pay us for that either. So no one noticed, no nothing, you know, bounce check. And, so we're all sitting down here and the train comes up here and tries to get the coal that we've mined to take it out and sell it. So, yeah, that rubbed everybody a little bit the wrong way. And, you know, when somebody does something wrong, somebody's got to do something. And this is our something right here.
Well, you sure acted quickly and appropriately because you are a peaceful group and all you want is what you are owed. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody signs up for on-stage work, on-stage pay. You know, that's, that's what you agree to back here, and we don't want anything more than that. It hurts a little bit that the guy had done most of it. You know, Jeff Hoops, before he filed bankruptcy, he took out like $50-some million of his company and put it somewhere else. I mean, it's just a crooked guy at the top. And no matter which side you're on, I mean, crooked guy's always going to be crooked. So when that happens, you know, everybody hurts to him.
Yeah. So tell us about the support you are receiving. And at the end, I want you to tell our listeners what they can do if they're listening. What kinds of support and help are you receiving? Is the UMWA helping you or other unions or other organizations?
Oh, yeah. The UMWA has been in here, you know, a couple times, and it's been outreach from all across the world, to be honest. I mean, England, Germany. I mean, I'm glad it's got as much news as it has because maybe somebody else won't have to go through this again, you know, because somebody should have to pay for it. And if you want to help, from Love with Harlan, you can donate there. And, you know, they come in here, give us water, food. I mean, but we got support all across the nation and, you know, other countries.
Oh, wonderful. So can you say that again, the place where people can give support?
Yeah, go online. It's From Love with Harlan. And that's where you donate to. And,
okay.
You know, that's the one we all go through down here and we all trust. And it's a good place. And they help us out a lot from light bills to just food, you know, because for a while there, when the company first shut us down, you know, they just said we not laid off, not fired, so we couldn't even draw unemployment. So there's a lot of guys down there, we couldn't get any kind of money coming in there for a while, so it's really hurtful because schools about to restart back, so we needed a lot of stuff at the beginning.
Are you being harassed at all by Black Jewel? Do they start up the train to intimidate you, or... How is that happening? Is there anything like that?
Yeah, as far as that goes, the train tracks, the CSX, you know, they're the guys that got the cars loaded right now on the train. And they support us too, you know, they know because they're a union. They stand up for what's right too. So, you know, they're with us on that too. So, no, not much harassment right now, to be honest with you. We're just trying to do what's right.
Okay, yes, because that's a dangerous thing, blocking a train. So that, you know, so I'm just wondering about that. So how do your local officials respond to the protest? Are they supporting you, like local politicians and things?
Oh yeah, a lot of support. The mayor has been great. I mean,
terrific.
Matt Duggan's been here. I mean, everybody trying to support as much as they can. But Chris Rhodes, actually, if you want to talk to him for a little while and get his opinion on some stuff. Chris was here if you want to talk to him for a little bit.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Feel
okay,
free.
Hold on one second. You talk to Chris.
Okay, Chris.
Yeah,
hi.
Hey.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking the stand you're taking. It certainly is awe-inspiring. I was asking Will how the local officials were responding, and he says the mayor is giving you support and things like that. What rulings have come down from the courts?
Well, no major rulings have come yet, but they are actually putting a bill into play, trying to get it passed through right now, of the bonds that these coal companies have to purchase when they open the mines. So they're actually putting a law into effect right now to 100% guarantee that this won't happen again.
Okay. Okay.
As far as ruling for, you know, what's happened to us within the bankruptcy court, we've not reached one yet. We're hoping that it's going to be pretty quick, and we think it's not going to be much longer.
Okay, so you're pretty optimistic about getting your money back from Black Jewel and maybe the mine reopening?
Yes, yes. We've had several different hearings, and every hearing that we have had has been pretty much on our side, you know. I'm pretty optimistic that it's going to be a good outcome.
Chris, also, how long have you been a coal miner? Did you expect this?
I've been coal mining for 11 years.
Okay, and did you all expect this, or was this a total surprise?
No. You know, we deal with layoffs on a regular basis here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have noticed, and the companies take care of us when we do have a layoff. But this one here was not expected. We showed up to work one day, and they tell us to go home, and that was it. You know, we didn't have a clue anything was going on. And then they pulled our bounced checks back out of our bank account. So, yeah, you know, this was not a typical layoff.
On the while you're protesting, do you discuss issues about the coal industry itself with the environmental issues, and how do most coal miners feel about that?
You know, we have a lot of different discussions, but the main one that we keep around here is just about how we need to make a stand for all the other coal mining companies to see. You know, you just can't do your employees the way that Black Jewel has done. And that's the main reason that we've made the stand that we have, is to make that point. You know, we're tired of being robbed. And this right here, it drawed the final straw. And hopefully we can make a difference to where fellow miners will be treated a little better.
Oh, my gosh, you're so creative in what you did. I mean, to block the coal that you just mined. That was really amazing. And to anyone who works, not getting paid for what you work, that was very brave of you and very forward-looking. And we all thank you for that. So,
well, we appreciate all the support from everyone. You know, all the radio that's put us out, all the news stations that's put us out, that's the biggest thing that has helped us get our word out the way it needs to be out, is all of you guys.
Well, we sure owe you a debt of gratitude, because this has happened, and I understand bankruptcies within the coal industry also are more common than used to be. Can you tell me about the area you're in? Harlan County is noted for its militancy and its history, rich history of coal mining towns and things like that.
Harlan is basically made up of 95% of the population is coal miner. That coal mining is our livelihood here in Harlan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a long time since we've had anything like this happen. Like I said, you know, we've had layoffs and things of that nature, but nothing like this. The last time that anything like this happened, I believe it was in the 70s.
Correct, yes.
And, you know, it was pretty nasty then. And, you know, back then is when we got the name Bloody Harlan. I don't know if you've heard that name yet or not, but it was one of the strikes that was it was pretty intense, and we got out the name Bloody Harlan.
And, yes,
It's a way of our life right here in Harlan, and you know, that's to make any kind of money and to make a honest living. That's what we have here. It's coal mining.
Yes, and I was glad to see on some of the videos that the news channels have done. You make it clear you're a very peaceful group, but that you
Most definitely. You know, there's no sense in violence and just being plain out rude. There's no sense in it. I mean, you know, we're here to, we came out to make a point of not that, you know, how wrong we were done of being robbed. And there's just no sense in the violence and all that. You get nowhere with violence. The best way that you can handle situations is being mature about it. And, you know, that's what we vowed to do when we started this.
and also taking the stand that you did. It, you know, again, I say gratitude from all of us, of all people that work for a living. You know, people are owed what they work for. So you guys are leaders.
Yeah.
So
that's why I say we appreciate all of the support and all of everybody that has donated and come by and everything. We appreciate everybody.
So we have about 2 minutes left, and if you or Will want to say anything else, and I do want you to repeat where people can send money or food or anything that you need for our listeners if they so want to.
Okay. The donations and stuff that we have been having sent in is to With Love from Harlan. And you can get on to Facebook and pull them up. It'll give you all the information of the address to send whatever to. And, you know, we just want to make it a point to all these coal companies and in industry there is. That, you know, you can't treat employees just however you want to. You know, we respect the companies that we work for, and we bust our hind ends for them, and we want it in return. And I believe I speak for every worker in the United States that they feel the same way. You know, we put out work, and we respect the companies, and we just want that same respect back. So, you know, just the only thing that I can say is just stand up for what's right. You know, don't try to make a stand for things that's ridiculous, you know, because you didn't get a cup of coffee or something from the company. If you're getting robbed the way that we did, then make a stand for yourself and make it right.
Well said, Chris, and we thank you so much for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
And we thank you.
It's a working man I am, and I've been down underground. I swear to God, if I ever see the sun, or for any length of time, I can hold it in my mind. I never again will go down underground. At the age of 16 years, he quarreled with his peers, who vowed there'd never be another one. In the dark recess of the mine, where you age before your time, and the cold dust lies heavy on your lungs. It's a working man I am, and I've been down underground. And I swear to God, if I ever see the sun, or for any length of time, I can hold it in my mind. I never again will go down underground.
Ebony's Bones is a kitchen table conversation that explores the souls of Black folk as we decolonize and question everything that we've been told to believe. Tune in Thursday, September 12th. At 7 p.m. and have a seat at the table.
Thanks for tuning into KKFI. Well, folks, the future's here. Simply tell your smart speaker, play KKFI. If you haven't already, give it a shot. KKFI, wherever you are.
Did you miss one of your favorite programs this week? No worries. Now you can listen to any of our programs from the last 2 weeks at archive.kkfi.org.
Well, let me introduce myself. Jack Shyster is my name. I'm a management consultant. Union busting is my game. I'm a master of the con job. I'm an expert at the hoax, and I make my living stealing bread from the mouths of working folks. I'm a union buster, the bosses trust the aid. I help keep their employees overworked and underpaid.
He's a union buster, the bosses trust the aid. He helps keep their employees overworked and underpaid.
And that was Joe Glazer with Union Buster, and I'm Judy Ansel. And if you're old enough to remember PATCO, then you probably blame Ronald Reagan for changing the course of labor-management relations in 1981 when he fired over 11,000 striking professional air traffic controllers. They were federal workers and thus barred from striking. In 2011, labor historian Joseph McCartan wrote a book about it called Collision Course. It took me all this time to get around to reading it, and when I did, I knew I wanted to interview McCartan about it because it busted a lot of myths I had about the strike, Reagan, the Union, PATCO, and its historical significance. Joseph McCartan teaches at Georgetown University. He's written several labor history books, including with Melvin Dubofsky, We Shall Be All, A History of the IWW. He also has just published an article with longtime labor strategist Stephen Lerner and Sarita Gupta, who just stepped down as ED of Jobs with Justice. The article is called Why the Labor Movement Has Failed and How to Fix It. Maybe we'll get around to asking him about that. It's in the Boston Review. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, Judy. It's a pleasure to be with you. That was a beautiful introduction. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And so let's get right into it. First, the strike. Your book has many chapters before we even get to the strike because right. There's a very long buildup. What were the grievances of the air traffic controllers, and how did they try to get things fixed before they actually went on strike in August of 1981?
Well, that's a great point, Judy. When I started the book, I had no idea. You know, I thought it would be a short book. The strike, was pretty much broken within a couple of months. But as I got into it, I realized that actually it had been building for almost 20 years. Going back to the early 1960s and what air traffic controllers were starting to encounter in with their manager, the Federal Aviation Administration, with the understaffing of air traffic control facilities and with technology that was lagging behind their needs. And, you know, what motivated controllers to begin to organize in the early 60s were a couple of terrible disasters, mid-air collisions, that, you know, really shook up air traffic controllers. And they came to realize that the FAA was more determined to protect its image than to really do a searching inquiry into what was wrong with the system. So controllers started to organize, and it took them a long time to build a union. They didn't establish PATCO until 1968. And then, you know, they used direct action when they had to get attention to their issues. Once they formed a union, they staged a sick out in 1970, for example. But, you know, it was a long struggle for them to deal with a number of different issues all through the 70s, and that kind of culminated in what happened in 1981, when in the first 9 months of his administration, Reagan broke that union in a very public strike, as you've indicated, and one that I do think changed and altered the course of labor relations.
Well, yeah, and we're going to get to that. You know, two things. One was that I know, at least from your book, PATCO, the union, felt that the FAA simply didn't address the grievances that they had, particularly grievances around workload and technology, not having modern technology, and and stress. But also, you know, postal workers had gone on strike in 1970 successfully and won labor law reform for all the postal office employees. And so they had that example, thinking, well, if the postal workers could do it, they could do it too. But in fact, it turned out 10 years later to be much different times and a very different experience. So How did the government break the strike?
Well, they prepared for it, and they actually began preparing for it when Jimmy Carter was president, and that was one of the things that made my view of the strike more complicated as I got into it, because like you, and as you were alluding to at the beginning, I lived through this strike as a 22-year-old. I watched it unfold, and it seemed like Reagan was the only villain, but actually the strike-breaking plan was put together during the Carter administration, and it was during the time when Carter was president that PATCO leaders just became so frustrated with their inability to get the FAA to address their issues that they developed a strike plan and put in place the mechanisms that would allow them to be able to walk out in 1981. So the reason the government was able to break this strike is they were preparing for it for at least 3 years. And, the controllers prepared, but so did the government. And they used every mechanism at their disposal to break the strike. I argued in the book that this was the most expensive strike to break of any strike that's ever occurred. It cost multiple billions of dollars to the economy and to the government to try to break this strike. And there was only one employer that had the resources to go that far to break a union, and that was the federal government. So they used military controllers to engage in air traffic control. When they fired the controllers, they brought in military controllers. They also, because many airlines had to cut back on flights, they hired pilots to work part-time to help out in air traffic control. And they rushed through classes of new recruits, even going so far, as was later documented, to alter test scores of controller trainees so that they wouldn't wash out and they could be rushed into service. So they used every mechanism.
And I remember at the time, the union was saying, you're bringing in incompetent people to do the air traffic controlling. There's going to be some kind of disaster. But luckily, at least for the people who fly, there was no disaster.
Well, actually, that's a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
There was an event that I talk about in the book of in January of 1982, an Air Florida plane taking off at National Airport in Washington, D.C. during a snowstorm was unable to achieve elevation, crashed into the Potomac River.
Oh, that's right.
Now, later, and at the time, controllers said the reason that happened is that plane stood on the tarmac so long after it had been de-iced before it took off that it was unable to get airborne. And the reason it had to stand in line was that there weren't enough controllers to move the traffic. And this was indicative of how lucky Reagan was. The National Transportation Safety Board looked into it. They disputed the controllers' allegation about this, and they blamed the crash solely on the pilots of the plane. But it could have gone the other way with Reagan, but he was able to dodge that bullet.
Okay, so I want to do a little myth-busting here.
Okay.
One, PATCO was too big for its britches in thinking that they couldn't be replaced. That was arrogant. Two, they failed to develop strong ties with the AFL-CIO, thinking they really didn't need solidarity with the rest of labor. That was delusional.
Mm-hmm.
Three, they endorsed Ronald Reagan in 1980, thinking he'd do what he promised them he'd do, which is give him a contract.
Right.
That was naive. Basically, they were a bunch of amateurs who didn't get politics. Does that sum it up?
You make a... It's a pretty good summary of some of the main points. I mean, these folks who engaged in this action in 1981, most of them had never participated in any sort of strike before. And not only were they striking in this case, but they were striking against the ultimate employer, the most powerful employer in the country. And so they were in, I think, over their head. They didn't strategize sufficiently in advance. They did not develop the ties to the AFL-CIO that they should have. They were one thing they didn't pay attention to was how to frame their strike to the public. They didn't think that much about that. They made demands in bargaining, like a $5,000 across-the-board increase, that to the public sounded completely tone-deaf in the middle of the Reagan recession, as it was called, when a lot of workers were, unionized workers were engaging in give-back contracts, concessionary contracts. These controllers were demanding a $5,000 across-the-board increase. And, you know, many taxpayers said, hey, wait a minute, I'm going to have to pay for that. And moreover, they don't even have a right to demand that. You know, in the federal service, you don't have a right to bargain over your pay. So none of those things were things that helped PATCO. They didn't build friends. They didn't frame their strike well. They were a bit naive about Reagan. All of those things were true. It's a complicated story, and right. I came to, you know, great sympathy for these folks, even as I could see some of the mistakes they'd made.
Sure. And one of the things you highlighted was the fact that they had thought that the pilots would support them, but in fact the pilots hated them. Why was that?
And that was really devastating for them.
Yeah. They hadn't built those ties, and they had done some things that alienated the airline
pilots.
Well,
here's one thing about the pilots, and that was, and this I think they didn't think this through, that when they went on strike, the airlines immediately laid off, you know, many, many pilots because they knew they were going to have to cut back on traffic. And, of course, even the threat of a strike, pilots were like, well, hey, we're going to be hit by this, and it's going to be our paychecks that suffer, too. So they didn't develop an alliance there that would have been necessary for a successful strike.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about Reagan, okay?
Sure.
So, you know, he was a former union president.
Only ever to be president of the U.S., that's right.
Even though he ratted on leftist members of the Screen Actors
Indeed.
Guild during the McCarthy era. As governor of California, he was anti-farm worker, publicly eating grapes on TV in defiance of the boycott. He vetoed collective bargaining for farm workers, et cetera, et cetera. This was not exactly a pro-labor guy. But you know, in your book, he doesn't come off as bad as I thought.
Well, that was what his secret was. Like all the things you mentioned definitely happened. But then there was another side to what Reagan was trying to do at the time that was, I think, underappreciated and underreported. And that was he did make a real outreach to unions on some level. As governor of California, this same guy who was, you know, had no sympathy whatsoever for the farm workers or Cesar Chavez, he actually signed a bill that widened the collective bargaining rights for government workers in California. And when some of the first government strikes hit state service while he was governor, he didn't take the kind of aggressive approach against those that he did later with PATCO. And in part, I think that was in keeping with the time because, like as you said earlier, the postal workers had struck when Richard Nixon was president. He didn't fire any of them.
No.
I think there was an attitude, even among some Republicans in the late 60s and early 70s, to try not to, take a let's obliterate them approach toward the union. They were trying to see if they could accommodate some union demands and you know, cultivate some union allies. Nixon cultivated the Teamsters, and Reagan tried to cultivate union allies as well.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why he reached out to get PATCO's endorsement in the 1980 election.
Well, and the government did actually negotiate with PATCO and made a contract offer that wasn't terrible, but the members of PATCO wanted much more and thought they could get much more. But I want to move on. First, very briefly, before we get to the historical significance of this, which I want to be sure we have time for, just talk a little bit about the personal cost of 11,000 air traffic controllers losing their jobs.
It was devastating. And again, and on a level that I don't think is approximated in any other strike, because, you know, we've known of strikes in history, of course, where the strikers were fired and blacklisted. Mm-hmm. But even in most of those cases, those people could go on to get jobs in the area that they've been working in somewhere else for some other employer. But the problem with air traffic controllers is that there was only one employer for their skill. They were fired by that employer, and they were blacklisted by that employer. Right. They didn't know how to do any other kind of job, and the kind of skills they had weren't easily transferable. So it had a devastating cost on families who controllers were fired from. It led to a lot of marriages breaking up. It led to suicides. It really sent some lives completely off the rails in a way that was really hard to recover from. So the human cost of 11,400 some people suffering that kind of firing was just simply immense.
And I just want to add that we're in Kansas City, and there were a lot of those folks here in Kansas City.
Because
they had an air traffic control center in Olathe, and they were big supporters of the strike. In fact, the last president of the union, Gary Eads, came from Kansas City, or he was based in Kansas City.
That's right. He worked in Olathe at that facility.
Right. So, but I want to get to the historical significance, and unfortunately we're running out of time. one of the things I thought was that even though the strike didn't change any laws, it did expose the weakness of labor. In many ways, yeah. It showed that labor was a paper tiger. Do you agree with that? That's one of the things it did?
I think it did. It was dispiriting to everybody in the labor movement because, very publicly, in front of the whole country, Reagan fired a group of highly skilled workers who, when those controllers went out, they didn't think that, when I've asked some of them, when Reagan came out in the Rose Garden and said he was going to fire you, what did you think? They said, we thought he was crazy because he couldn't run the planes without us. And that's what many people thought. So when Reagan fired them and then never rehired any of them, that sent a devastating message to people. And when the union movement, the best it could muster to do was maybe engage in some solidarity pickets at local airports, that seemed to reveal that the labor movement couldn't defend vulnerable strikers in the most publicized, most visible strike since World War II.
Right.
Everybody in the country watched this happen, and when the labor movement couldn't do anything about it, it really took the wind out of the movement, I think.
So many people I talk to about this say, we should have had a general strike. If we had all walked out, Reagan wouldn't have gotten away with it. Is that even remotely possible?
It wasn't in that time. I look into that thing in the book, and one thing I found was that there was no way there was going to be a general strike produced in that moment because the unions closest to PATCO weren't willing to go out. And if they weren't willing to go out, how could you get people who had nothing to do with that sector of the economy to go out? The unions, are, first of all, the pilots, and as we said, they were against the controllers' strike, but also the machinists who maintain the planes. And they were led at that time by a very militant president, Wimpy Wimpensinger, who was a great opponent of Reagan, but Wimpy knew that his own members weren't ready to strike for the controllers, right. And they didn't.
Yeah.
And if you couldn't get Wimpy to strike, how could you build a general strike?
Right.
Unfortunately, it wasn't really a possibility then. And that speaks to the question of, you know, a strike like that can't happen without greater involvement of other unions in it before it occurs. You can't build solidarity retroactively.
Yeah.
So one
last question.
Why people hope for that?
Because we're just out of time, and so in 15 yeah. seconds, tell me this: is there still a PATCO syndrome? Are unions still suffering from the fear of striking?
I think so. Except I see glimmers of change. Look at what happened with teachers in the past year and a half or
uh-huh.
so. So I think maybe that's finally dispelling that PATCO syndrome.
And even during the federal shutdown, some workers
Indeed.
Started calling in sick. This was the first
time.
That was
remarkable. Air traffic controllers called in sick, and right. they helped stop that shutdown.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
We're out of time. Thank you so much, Joe McCartan, for talking to us about your book, Collision Course. I really recommend
Great.
It to everybody. Thanks again.
Thank you, Judy. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
When you get another day older and deeper in debt, say, Pinky, don't you call me because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Those are words from the traditional American coal mining song, 16 Tons. Tonight, I want to speak to you about the Battle of Blair Mountain of West Virginia in 1921, widely considered the largest armed conflict to occur in the United States after the Civil War. The Battle of Blair Mountain was the inevitable result of years of bitter labor struggle between the mine owners and the men who did the work of the mine. Not only were safety conditions deplorable and black lung virtually guaranteed, but miners also exerted a mind-blowing degree of control over their workers. Not only were workers forced to live in company-owned housing, but they were often even leased their tools by the company and paid their low wages not in actual money, but in company scrip, which was only honored at mine owner-owned company stores. According to West Virginia labor historian Doug Epstep, the coal industry was essentially the state's sole source of work, and massive corporations built homes, general stores, schools, churches, and recreational facilities in the remote towns near the mines. For miners, this system resembled something like feudalism. Sanitary and living conditions in the company houses were abysmal, wages were low, and state politicians supported wealthy coal company owners rather than miners. Unionization had long been underway across the coal regions of the United States, with bloody and difficult yet often effective results. However, mine owners had managed through violence and coercion to keep the United Mine Workers Union out of the kill fields of Mingo, Logan, and McDowell counties in southern West Virginia. Finally, in 1920, the union came to Mingo County. Miners in Mingo failed to gain union recognition from the boss and decided to walk out on strike. The mine owners responded by hiring an army of private detectives, who were really more like mercenaries, from the Baldwin-Phelps Detective Agency to terrorize the miners. The Baldwin-Phelps boys set about evicting the striking miners and their families from their company-owned homes in the town of Matewan. A pro-union sheriff named Sid, who was a member of the Hatfield family, yes, that Hatfield family, intervened on the part of the strikers, and tensions escalated to a gunfight that left 7 dead agents, 2 dead miners, and the town of Matewan in need of a new mayor. The sparking point finally came on August 1, 1921, when Sheriff Hatfield was murdered by Baldwin-Phelps agents on the very steps of the county courthouse. Within days, thousands of union miners had gathered at the outskirts of the town of Marmette near the state capitol. They soon resolved to march en masse on Mingo County to effect the release of jailed union members there. Many were World War I veterans and came packing with their military-issue rifles, and others with their squirrel-hunting guns. Unfortunately, this marching route required the miners to pass through the company stronghold of Logan County. When the local anti-union sheriff, Don Chapin, heard about the marchers, he immediately resolved to prevent any armed mobs, as he put it, from entering Logan County. 3,000 state police, deputies, and citizen militiamen were assembled to repel the miners' march. On August 28th, over 10,000 miners and supporters had amassed at the Logan County border, and gunfire erupted. In order to keep up with who was supposed to be shooting at who, some miners improvised and tied red handkerchiefs around their necks, earning them the nickname the Redneck Army. The first heavy fighting in the Battle of Blair Mountain began on August 31st when an organized assault was made against the mine owner forces fortified on the mountainside. However, despite great bravery and tenacity on the parts of the miners, they were repeatedly repelled by the fortification and superior equipment, including machine guns, of the resistance. More progress was made the next day when a Gatling gun, liberated from a company store, was deployed against Craddock Fork, but miners were still ultimately repelled by superior firepower. The anti-union local sheriff even went so far as to charter three private biplanes to drop tear gas and pipe bombs loaded with nuts and bolts for shrapnel onto the miners' temporary bases, but no injuries were inflicted. For the rest of the day, the hills and hollows echoed with gunfire as the union men repeatedly attacked the defenders' lines. A witness recalled that machine guns cracked up there so you would think the whole place was coming down on you, miner Ira Wilson later recalled. Finally, fighting ended on September 4th with the arrival of 2,100 Army troops on order of President Warren G. Harding. Although estimates of the casualties range from 20 to 100, estimates are that as many as 1 million rounds were fired during the conflict. Although ultimately the miners did not see any immediate victories out of the conflict, the Battle of Blair Mountain has since been cited as a pivotal chapter in American labor history. I hope you've all enjoyed the show tonight and have a great evening.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, September 12, 2019. The Unitarian Universalist Forum, Sunday, September 15th, 10 a.m. at All Souls UU Church. The Community of Reason, Decolonizing Minds Through Multicultural Education to Save the Planet and All Life It Supports, with Lewis Duguid and Betty Tate Beaver. That is also Sunday, September 15th at 2 p.m., UMKC, Hague Hall, Room 301, 52nd and Rock Hill Road. Troublemaker School Organizer Training, also on Sunday, September 15th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the University of Kansas campus. To register, go to labornotes.org/Kansas. Workers' Rights Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, September 16th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Free service to help collect stolen wages. Next is Jobs with Justice Monthly Organizing Committee Meeting, Tuesday, September 17th, 6:30 p.m. at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Get involved in economic justice. All are welcome. The Sunrise Movement Climate Strike is Friday, September 20th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the J.C. Nichols Fountain, 47th and Main, KCMO. The Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, September 21st, 8:15 for breakfast and 9 o'clock for the speaker. Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. The speaker is Barry Grissom and others.
Okay, and that's it for the show. To find our calendar and our upcoming schedule, as well as our archived shows, go to heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the show. We're going to be talking about the cruise ship blues and two bills to protect the right to organize and end tax breaks for outsourcing. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
Still got our pride. 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.